coming up next on RCR. Speak Free with Simon O'Connor. In a topsy-turvy world, good old-fashioned ideas may seem foreign to some, but still make a lot of sense to many. Join Simon as he speaks with local and international guests to explore the values and perspectives that shape our world. Get your common sense fixed with conversations that celebrate democracy, freedom, and our fundamental rights. It's Speak Free with Simon O'Connor, right here on RCR, Reality Check Radio.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to Speak Free with me, Simon O'Connor. Welcome back to regular listeners, or if this is the first time you've tuned in, look, welcome to the show. It's a show where we celebrate, if you will, our values that we share, the traditions, our understandings, and where we talk to a wide variety of guests from both here and overseas. And as the title suggests, we speak freely. We speak to all types of people on all sorts of topics. And for me personally, the show is really important about providing a platform for people to share their views. And so it's something I'm thoroughly enjoying. Although, as I was saying, well, I keep saying it almost every week, I'm amazed how fast time goes. I'm just amazed that I'm back in the chair. It just feels like yesterday, almost literally, feels like yesterday that I was doing last week's show. And here I am again. And I'm actually reminded of something Rachel often says. It's a quote or an axiom. Actually, it's probably not strictly an axiom. Let's just say it's a saying that she uses. The days are long, but the years go quickly. I think that's true in and of itself. But I think there's some truth in that when I think about doing this show. It just flies by. Just flies by. But I love it. Hey, we have a huge show. Huge show today. I've got Ashley Church coming on. He's a housing commentator. He is, and it's my turn here, he's a little bit of a contrarian to a lot of the stuff you read and hear. So if you've been following the news of late, you've got government ministers and other commentators saying we've got to drop house prices, we've got to build more houses, there's got to be more interventions. Well, actually, it's actually Ashley has a separate set of thoughts. And he's a man who knows housing. He's a regular housing commentator and great with statistics. So we'll be chatting to him. I'm also really pleased to let you know that I've got Toby Young from the Free Speech Union from the United Kingdom coming on to chat. So he's in New Zealand at the moment on a tour. So he comes on to talk about free speech, obviously the importance of free speech, but he updates me and us. Well, I hope he's going to update us on what's happening in the United Kingdom and his observations of what's happened and happening here in New Zealand. And I've also got Rachel coming on. She's agreed. She's able to find some time today. So look, a big, big show. Looking forward to the next hour or two with you, actually. But as we go through it, of course, if you've got any thoughts or comments, challenges or otherwise, email me at inbox@realitycheck.radio. Or text 2057.
You're listening to Speak Free with Simon O'Connor, right here on RCR, Reality Check Radio.
Well, another big week with no shortage of news to reflect on. I think one of the things that struck me actually as I was thinking about the show today was I picked up the Herald of all things a couple of days ago, and I just wanted to share this with you because it just shows the inherent contradictions and inconsistencies which are all around us. So the first article I was reading was talking about segregated or exclusionary zones at the University of Auckland. The university was defending having spaces for Māori and Pacifica only in this particular case. And, you know, it's not to go down the rabbit hole of that particular argument, but it was just interesting that the university and, in effect, the reporter were saying, look, exclusion is fine, segregating is fine. And then when I flicked to the next article, because I was on my iPad, the next article was all about trans sport. And the head of Sports New Zealand, is it Raylene Castles, is saying that inclusion is the most important factor, that sport has to always be inclusionary. And I just thought it was, again, quite funny. One article is advocating inclusion in the name of progressive woke values, And the next article, in the name of progressive woke values, is arguing for exclusion. I just find it mind-boggling that basically completely contradicting situations can be celebrated. But anyway, I just thought I'd highlight that, I suppose, as much as an encouragement to always delve much deeper in and behind the stories, which again is one of the reasons why I'm on Reality Check Radio with you all, is, you know, let's talk about the issues that matter. And as you're seeing with some of the other hosts and researchers, delving deeply into issues. The other thing which will not surprise you that's been on my mind was the visit of the Chinese premier, New Zealand laying out the red carpet. Just a couple of points of observation. He might be the number two, but he holds no power because it's a communist regime. President Xi Jinping holds all the power. So the number two's just a figurehead. Look, good that he's here at one level. You know, trade's important for New Zealand. But one thing that just highlights what's going on, because it's radio, I can't show it to you, but I've obtained various WeChat messages of student associations, Chinese student associations here in New Zealand, basically offering money for students to turn out to wave flags and banners in support of the visiting premier. You know, I had to get a friend to translate it from Mandarin for me, but they're offering free accommodation, free transport, 3 free meals a day, and what they're terming a special gift at the end, which my sources tell me is probably hundreds of dollars each. And I just thought it was representative about how the CCP operates. It's all about making sure the optics are right and good. And so when you see, well, over the recent days, the people waving their flags and banners, most of them have been paid to be there, except, of course, the human rights activists, the Tibetans, the Uyghurs, New Zealand Chinese, who are all for democracy. They are there because they believe in human rights. So I just thought that was striking. I'll see if there's some way I can put those texts up, maybe on my Facebook page or RCR, so you can see what I mean. But those are certainly two things that have been on my mind this week. But always let me know what you are thinking by email at inbox@realitycheck.radio or text 2057.
Our text machine is now live. Send us your thoughts by texting your message to 2057. That's 2057. So get in touch with us now.
So I'm with Ashley Church. He's a commentator on a number of issues and well-respected. But one of them that he's been commenting on for quite some time is around housing. So Ashley, welcome to the show.
G'day, Simon. Nice to talk to you and good to see you on RCR.
Oh, well, I'm enjoying it. It's a great station. We've touched on all sorts of views or topics, rather, from Taiwan to the monarchy that is, the curriculum through to how my wife met. So I thought we should get onto a serious topic and talk about housing in New Zealand.
Yeah.
Well, to throw you a look, let's just jump straight in because it's something a lot of people talk to me on the street about. They're worried about first home buyers, they're worried about rental, mortgage payments, they're concerned we're not building enough houses. But if I might, you've often had a slightly different take on issues. And I know of late the now national government or the coalition government, whatever they're calling themselves, has been pushing a particular set of views or lines, and you haven't always agreed. So tell us what's going on or not going on in the New Zealand housing market, according to Ashley Church.
Yeah, so you're right. I have taken a different viewpoint quite consistently, almost belligerently so, over the last sort of 10 years. Certainly with respect to the previous government, who just were noddies, who didn't have a clue about how the property market worked, but also with regard to the current government, with regard to some of the positions that they have taken, which, while I understand why they might have taken them instinctively, are not necessarily going to solve the housing issues that the country faces. And it's interesting because when you have this debate around the housing market and dealing with the housing crisis, and that's a term you hear a lot in the media, Simon, When you use this term housing crisis, there's actually three quite different things that people mean when they use that term, and they're almost mutually exclusive. So there's a group of people for whom the housing crisis is the fact that for them, house prices have got out of control and they're too expensive, and therefore as a result of that, people can't afford to buy homes, particularly first-time buyers. And as a result of that, and so that's the housing crisis. The crisis is the fact that house prices are too high. And then there's and then there's another group, completely different group of people, for whom the housing crisis is not about house prices so much. It's about homelessness. It's about this idea that there are people who are living rough on the street, or who are living in very, very temporary accommodation, and therefore the crisis is not so much about what house prices cost, but it's about the fact that there are people who simply can't access homes, and therefore that's what the crisis is, and that's what the government should be addressing. And then there's a third group, and that's this group of people saying, no, it's not about either of those two things. The housing crisis is about a shortage of housing. So it's about this idea that we haven't built enough houses over the last 40 or 50 years, and therefore we don't have enough homes, and we need to build more homes quickly in order to increase supply and get it back to a point where the country can actually, you know, see itself as being in a reasonable position again. So really important, firstly, to understand that there is not one housing crisis, there's three. There are quite specific adherents of each of those positions, and they are to some degree mutually exclusive from each other. So does that make sense?
It does. It does. I mean, can I just tease at least one of them out? Because, you know, number three, you talk about the housing shortage, and I hear about that a lot. But as I drive about or fly about, for me, there are just, and this is only anecdotal, but there are new houses being built left, right, and centre. I'm looking out my home window at the moment, and the number of subdivisions is phenomenal. So to me, and again, I really want to stress it's anecdotal, there seems to be lots of houses. So is it that we're just still not producing enough? I mean, what's going on there?
I'll come back to that a little bit later on, because I want to sort of work through some of the other issues first, but that's a really good observation, so thank you for that. By the way, when I talk about these three issues, if I was to define this current government in respect of its position on housing and what it sees as the crisis, that last one, that supply one, is probably the one that probably best defines Chris Bishop's position. He sees housing shortage as being the crisis that him and the national government need to solve. But let's go to each of those individually, because my argument is, and you talked before about having a different view, my argument is that, in fact, each of those crises aren't crises at all. And that when you look at the reality and the facts of what's going on underneath the surface with the housing market, that all three of those can be dismissed for different reasons. So let me start with the first one, this idea that that house prices are too expensive. And look, anecdotally, you can understand why people would hold that view. House prices have doubled every decade for the last 40 years. They've doubled and then doubled again and then doubled again and then doubled again. And we can prove that. We know that by looking at the house price data. And house prices obviously incomes obviously haven't gone up by the same degree. So you can understand why people might look at that and say, well, gosh, you know, house prices have increased dramatically. Therefore, the result of that has been that we've now got house prices out of control. So the problem with that is, whether it's right or wrong, and this is really my first point, you actually can't control house prices. So my first advice to the minister would be, you cannot control what happens to house prices. And there have been governments over the last 40 or 50 years in this country who've been ground on the rocks of failure on that. Governments that have come in thinking they could control house prices, doing different things to control house prices, doing stuff around immigration, doing stuff around consenting with councils, all sorts of other things, some of which this new government's trying to do again, which have made, and this is really important to understand, Simon, not one jot of difference to house prices over that 40-year period, not one jot of difference to bring them up or down. And there's a really good reason for that. It's because house prices aren't controlled by all of the various things that you instinctively think they might be. When I say the one driver, about 90% of all house price growth, and you can demonstrate this empirically if you look at graphs and charts, about 90% of all house price growth is driven almost exclusively by the declining cost of money over the last 40 years. And what that means is, as the cost of mortgages comes down, or the cost of mortgage finance comes down, house prices have come up. And that link is so strong that you can actually demonstrate it empirically on a chart. You can show what's happened since the mid-80s when we had mortgage interest rates sitting at over 21%, and what's happened in the 40-odd years since, and house prices are now at the levels that they're at. So as the cost of money has come down, the house prices have increased over that same period of time. And that link is now so strong that to deny it is to deny reality. And what that means is, and you can actually see a really good example of that happening right now, the Reserve Bank's going through this process of trying to get inflation under control, and it's doing that by putting the OCR up, which is causing mortgage interest rates to go up. What's happened to house prices? They've stabilized or even dropped. In fact, they went through a period where they dropped in some parts of the country by almost 20%. So that causal link between the two is absolutely proven.
So elements that you mentioned, consent, some people would say like the price of building and so forth. You're saying that these are not, they must be factors. Of course they are, but they're not material.
Yeah, there's immigration controls, there's regulation, there's the discouraging of land banking. I'm reading from a list here. Discouraging from unoccupied homes, banning foreign buyers, punishing property investors, removing the urban-rural boundary, which is a big thing that Chris Bishop's working on at the moment. All of this stuff has been around trying to control house prices by focusing on a feature of the market. The problem with those is if they impact on house prices at all, it's on the fringes. It's a tiny percentage of the total overall impact. The overall impact is 80 to 90% of house price increases have been due to the declining cost of money.
So if I put it in sort of simplistic Simon terms, the fact, because I always remember my folks talking about their first house and 21% interest and so on. Yeah. At the moment, because mortgage rates are so much lower than they used to be, I mean, up to a few years ago, my mortgages started with a 2, which were good, should have locked them in for longer. But long and short, if mortgage rates are lower, that means there's more money, there's more capital, which means more people have saved money to try and buy a house, which makes it more competitive, which ultimately drives the market up. Would that be a fair summation?
Absolutely. And the last 40 years has been absolutely it's absolute evidence of that. That's what the market's done. As the cost of money has come down, the ability to purchase, to pay more for housing has gone up. Now, there's a second point to this. There's a corollary of this, which is that, okay, so the first point I'm making is to the minister or to anybody else who's interested in this stuff, you actually can't control house prices. There's nothing short of regulating mortgage interest rates, and, you know, good luck with that. There is actually nothing that a government can do to control house prices up or down. The market will do what it does based on what's happening with the cost of money. But here's the second point of the points I want to make. Second point is, why would you want to stop house price growth? And when I say that, people, you know, they gasp as if, oh my God, what does that mean? Are you actually suggesting that house prices should continue to increase? And the answer to that is absolutely yes. And let me give you some reasons why, because people don't actually sit down and think this stuff through, Simon. If you think about what's happened with house price growth over the last 40-odd years and what that's done. So the first thing to understand is that there's a Swiss-based crowd called Credit Suisse, and Credit Suisse do a survey once, I think it's every 5 years, where they measure the wealthiest nations in the world. Now, I think in 2020 was the last time they did it, and that report came out and it measured New Zealand as the fifth wealthiest nation on earth. Now, that's not about individual incomes. It's about assets and about wealth that people actually hold. And they went on in that report to say that most of that wealth that was held by New Zealanders was in the form of real estate, because a big chunk of Kiwis own their home and house prices have continued to increase. Now, here's the thing. When you look at what Kiwis do with that, what do they do with the equity in their home? So they buy a house. There's a period of time where they've got a small amount of equity being the difference between what you paid for it and what it's worth. And that grows over time as your mortgage stays the same or reduces, but the value of the house increases. And as that gets bigger, you can use that as a security. And what do people do with it? They establish and buy businesses. They fund business cash flow. They travel. They fund lifestyle improvements on their home or in other ways. They spend within their local economies. They provide their kids with opportunities, including education. They fund community services through their rates. And there's a whole range of other things. So my argument is that house price growth and the ability to use that growth for equity to do other things has actually been an enormously beneficial factor in our society. And in fact, it's not only has it been the driver of growth over a 40-year or 50-year period, but it's what's made us one of the fourth or fifth wealthiest nations on the planet. And long may that continue. And you know, you need to temper that by saying people are buying homes and paying more for them because they can afford to and because their own wealth is increasing. So when that stops, when we get to a point where they can no longer afford it, the market will be self-regulating. People will stop doing that. Now, there is a third point to that, and people say, well, that's fine for you, actually, because you've got a home of your own. And
I'm about to raise where I think you're going to say, look, if you're already a homeowner, your argument makes sense. But I think you're about to anticipate there. What about someone who's trying to get on that ladder?
Totally. And that's exactly what people say. They say, well, that's all very well for you because you've already got your own home, and so you're not impacted by what's happening with house prices. But what about those poor people who are looking at getting into their first home? What about them? They can't afford it. Well, here's the really interesting thing, and this is where the argument starts to get really interesting, is house ownership numbers aren't declining. And Simon, they haven't been declining for about 100 years. And so when you ask people what percentage of homes do Kiwis own, they'll say, some people think we've got the highest rate of home ownership in the world. We don't. We never have had. Some people think it's really low. You're probably aware of the actual figure. A lot of people won't be. The average home ownership rate of Kiwis going back to about 1926 is about 64-65%. And here's what's interesting. That's almost exactly the same as the United States, Canada, the UK, and Australia. So all of those countries sit at about 64-65%. They deviate a little bit. New Zealand got a little bit higher some years back, a little bit lower. So, but by and large, that long-run average stays pretty much the same and has done for a really long period of time. Now, here's what's interesting. We're still right now sitting at about 65%. That figure hasn't changed. As I say, it went up in the late 80s. It went up to, got up to about 70. And there's a range of reasons for that, which I'm happy to discuss if you want to. But the long-run average hasn't changed over that period of time. So what that tells me is that even though house prices have increased exponentially, because they have since the 80s and gone up, doubled and doubled and doubled and doubled again, that the rate of ownership of homes by first-time buyers has actually kept pace with that. And what's interesting is when you look to see who's been buying homes over the last 20-odd years and you look at the mortgage take-up rates by the various different banks, first-time buyers, with the exception of a couple of quarters over the last 20 years, have almost without exception been the biggest group of buyers in the market. So they continue to be a significant purchaser of homes. So if I was looking at those numbers and I was saying house prices have gone up and as a result of their home ownership's gone down from 64 to 50 or 45, that would be a different conversation, but that's not what's happened. About 34, 35, 36% of Kiwis rent. The rest of the country, regardless of what period you're looking at, and remember over that period of time, we've gone from about a million people in 1926 to tapping on 5 million or more now, that percentage has stayed stubbornly the same. So that kills off that concern that people have got. And for me, it's confirmation that whatever is at play here, it's not doing damage to the first home buyers market in and of itself.
Do you have any thoughts then of why the narrative is the way it is? Because, I mean, my whole time in Parliament and before and still now is we've got a housing crisis, we don't have enough houses, too many migrants, too expensive, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And yet you're saying quite clearly that the statistic, the analysis, the numbers show that actually things are pretty much the same as they've always been in a general sense. So, I mean, why do you think we end up with this political or media narrative?
For the same reason that we've got people out there who are saying the tax system's unfair and unfair in favour of people who are wealthy, when exactly the opposite's the case. It's exactly the same argument. It's the so-called progressive agenda, which has got more which is more about the ideology of people who are making those comments than it is about the reality. Facts don't matter with this stuff. People ignore the facts because they don't support the argument. And that's not just true in this space. It's true in so many different things in life in the 21st century, unfortunately. But there is a very large group of people who buy into that. Well, firstly, there's a smaller group of people who say this stuff because the narrative's about a bigger political objective. And then there's a much larger group of people who don't know and they just believe what the headlines tell them. And a media who kind of feed into this stuff because, again, they don't know any better. When you take a bit of time, and it's true of all the stuff around the property market, and I guess if I've contributed anything over the last decade, it's been to simplify a lot of this stuff, is if you just take this stuff and you distill it down and you actually look at what the numbers tell you, it's not that complicated. And not only is it not that complicated, but the system actually works pretty well. And it's worked well for a long time. And when it does get to the point, yeah, it will. When it gets to the point where it is too expensive for house prices to continue doubling decade on decade, the market will moderate that on its own. It doesn't need a government to do it. It doesn't need a bank to do it. It will work it out on its own, and it will naturally settle into that. And that will take place over decades, not years. So as that happens, instead of taking 10 years for house prices to double, it might take 20 and then 30. But that'll happen over a long period of time.
So is there an argument, actually, that governments make things worse? And that's not arguing left or right, but actually the more governments try to intervene, the more complicated or messy it becomes. That being your observation, I'm thinking the likes of LVRs or loan to value ratios. I know now the Reserve Bank's looking at debt to income restrictions. So
the Reserve Bank, if you want to look for a culprit, so I said before that first home buyers have continued regardless of what's gone on the market, and I still believe that, and I still believe that they will. But their biggest enemy by a country mile is the Reserve Bank. And not only is their biggest enemy, it's not their enemy doing things that are good for the market overall. So if you know, you could say, oh well, look, I understand that whatever the Reserve Bank's doing is hurting first-time buyers, but they're doing it for this reason. There's none of that. They're doing stupid stuff for no reason. And I'll give you two really good examples. The first one is the loan-to-value ratio restrictions. Loan-to-value ratio restrictions came out in 2013 under Wheeler. And he introduced them at the time, and I love this story because people don't know it. You go back to when they did it, you went to their website and their press releases, they claimed they were doing it to reduce house prices. They claimed they were introducing the loan-to-value ratio restrictions to reduce house prices and bring house prices down. Over the next 5 or 10 years, house prices doubled. So it didn't work. About 5 years in from that, the Reserve Bank quietly changed its narrative, took off the original stuff on its website, got rid of the original, and just simply changed the narrative and said, actually, it was never about house prices. It was always about market stability. And so the argument moved from being it was about bringing house prices down to we're making the market more stable by making people produce a larger deposit. Now, the problem with that argument is that prior to them doing that, and in the, certainly in the late 2010s, up to 2010, 2011, you could buy a house with as little as 5% deposit. Market didn't collapse, Simon. Market carried on fine for the 20-odd years before that when a 5% deposit was perfectly acceptable. So my point in that is the Reserve Bank made absolutely no difference to the market whatsoever, but continued with this bloody-minded obsession with the LVR restrictions, even after it became obvious that they weren't actually producing what it was originally said that it was going to do. And I would argue that if there is an imposition to first-home buyers now, it's the LVR restrictions. And if you're not going to get rid of them in their entirety, then the next best thing would be to say, okay, we're not going to put them on first-time buyers. Because if you want to turbocharge first-time buying in the market, you'd get rid of the biggest imposition, which is a deposit, and make it easier for people to come up with a deposit to buy a house and enable the banks to actually lend to them. But they've not done that. Now, on top of that idiocy, there's a new set of idiocy, which is around the DTIs, the debt-to-income ratio restrictions. And the DTIs take this idiocy a step further, and they say, not only are we going to have our LVR restrictions where you can only, you've got to have a certain percentage before you can, as a deposit, before you can actually buy, but now we're going to tell you how much you can borrow. So if you're on a household income of 200,000, might be a couple in Wellington or Auckland or somewhere, or less than that if you're in other parts of the country, the maximum you'll be able to borrow will be, I think the figure they've come up with is $700,000. So if you live in Auckland, good luck. Good luck with that $700,000 minus your deposit or plus your deposit buying you a home. It's nonsensical. And there'll be some parts of the country where you can do that. There'll be some parts where you can't. And the problem with that is that, once again, the people who will be most penalised by this insidious policy are first-home buyers. Because if you've got a home, you've got a home, we've built up equity in our property. If we want to upgrade to a better property, all we're wanting to borrow is the difference between the property that we're selling and the one that we want to buy, the better home that we want to buy. So it's a much smaller loan. So that 7 times income for us isn't going to be such a problem. But if you don't have a house, so therefore you don't have equity in a property and you're starting from scratch, it's going to be a major. So I predict that that policy will be gone within 3 years. And I say that because its impact on the market will be far more insidious and far more devastating than even the muddle-headed LVR restrictions which came in some years ago. Both of these things, now I'd be saying to the minister, in this case to the Minister of Finance, to Nicola Willis, you should be taking the ability for these guys to off them. I believe that an independent reserve bank is a good thing, but this stuff's got nothing to do with inflation. This is nothing about inflation. This is nothing about keeping prices down in the market. This is about the Reserve Bank pursuing an obsession with nonsense. And in my view, this should be removed, and the minister should be taking this out of their remit the next time she renegotiates with Orr, who, frankly, in my view, shouldn't be in the job because he's incompetent and unable to do what a Reserve Bank governor should do. But that's a whole other issue. So
in many ways, you'd leave this with the banks. Then they are the ones who can make the decision of whether to loan to you or me or not, rather than what do they call the macroprudential tools.
Macroprudential, yeah, totally. This should be entirely with the bank. And again, the banks might come out and say, well, we're not going to go down to 5% deposits because we think that's unsafe. That's reasonable because that's the bank's own lending decision. They're entitled to do that. But the Reserve Bank shouldn't be making that decision. It's got no place in there, and it's making no difference to the market except to penalise the poor old first-home buyer. Because the reality is what would happen. Some banks would say, no, we're not going to do it because we think it's unsafe. And other banks would say, well, we are. So that's how competition in the market should work. You'd get competition and you'd get banks who were prepared to go. I don't know if you remember, but in the late 90s, as they were back then, United Bank introduced revolving credit facilities, which were an innovative thing back then. Nobody had them. No banks didn't have them. And now every bank offers them. And that just completely transformed the housing market, and all the other banks within about 12 months did the same thing as well because competition had forced them to do that. And that's what competition does. It's a great way of getting the best deal for the customer. Under the current system, we got Adrian Orr in the Reserve Bank deciding that they know better than you or I or the poor old first home buyer as a purchaser.
So in many ways, what you're suggesting is you're clearly a believer in the market. Let the market do what it wants to do. But part of your argument within this space is that ultimately governments and the Reserve Bank over many years have interfered tinkered around, played around, and actually made things worse.
Much worse. And mostly to the detriment of the poor old first home buyer, because the rest of us have got a bit of equity. So we could, you know, even property investors, because this is, all will claim that this is about getting investors out of the market. Well, no, it won't. I mean, it'll have a crack, but if property investors got a portfolio of more than a few properties, this isn't going to matter to them so much, because they've got enough equity to actually still be able to buy more properties, provided interest rates are at the right level. It's the first home buyer who's going to be hit by this stuff, and they'll be hit hard. And it's just nonsensical. There's no good reason for it.
We'll take a short break.
Right now, free speech is under heavy attack in New Zealand, with the government constantly devising new ways to enforce censorship. To revive honest media and support RCR, join our Foundation Membership Club today. To learn more, visit realitycheck.radio/members.
And we're back with Ashley Church here on Speak Free as we continue to talk about the housing market and wider dynamics here in New Zealand.
So the first one, remember right at the beginning, I talked about the first housing crisis or property was this idea that house prices were too expensive and that therefore it was. And so I think I put the death to that. I've said, firstly, you can't control house prices. Secondly, why would you want to? Because they've actually been a good thing, increasing house prices. And thirdly, the one group that you would think were actually adversely impacted by this, despite what I just said about Adrian Orr and the Reserve Bank, have actually managed to carry on at about the same. But so home ownership has stayed at around about the same percentage of the market. Similar numbers for about 100 years. So my argument is that puts the death to the first housing crisis claim. So that destroys the argument of anybody who makes that one. Second one, a bit more complex. And the second one is this idea that, by the way, any questions on that before we get off that on to the second?
No, well, only one last question if it's related, because the government's been tinkering around the interest deductibility. This is more in the rental space, ring fencing, interest loss as well, or rather as an expense. Do you see that sort of stuff as tinkering as well, or is that slightly different?
I'll come back to that. I'll get to that a little bit later on, because I deal with that in some detail. And it's a very good question. So the second one is this idea that the housing crisis is actually an issue of homelessness. And the last government was really big on this. It was this idea that that homelessness was the major blight on the market, and that we had thousands of people who were stuck on the social housing register. Now, for those who don't understand what that is, the social housing register is a register that's, and you'll know better than this from your days in government, which of the agencies currently administers it, MB?
So Ministry of Social Development administers it.
Now the social housing register is a register of want, not need. And let me explain what I mean, the difference between those two things. So the last government came out, they said, back in 2017, they said, we're going to solve the housing crisis, make it much easier for everybody, fill your boots. Basically, and without saying it, essentially implied, if you want a government house or a state house, we'll provide one. So the social housing register went from 6,000 people to 25,000 within the space of about 2 years. And I don't blame the people who put themselves on it, but they weren't necessarily people who needed a state house. There were people who saw that if I'm on a state house and I'm paying 30 to 40% of income or whatever the figure is of subsidized rental that I get on a state house versus what I might pay to the private sector, of course I'm going to want a state house. So when those numbers went up, they weren't necessarily a reflection of a greater degree of homelessness. They were a reflection of the fact that lots of people, and if I was in their position, I might have been the same, wanted a state house because it was going to be cheaper to be in one of those than it was to be in a private sector property. Now, here's the thing.
You'd almost be foolish not to put yourself on the list and think about it.
Of course. Now, that's not the reality. Most Kiwis, if you ask them about homelessness, they've got their idea of homelessness is this idea that you've got a whole lot of people who are living literally on the street. And so it's important to make the distinction between those two things, because according to Stats New Zealand, now these figures are a couple of years old, but they won't be made much different. There are two different types of homelessness. There's the first group, which is what we call the rough sleepers. And these are the people who either live literally on the street, or they live in improvised dwellings, and they're the people who you see in doorways and things in Auckland and Wellington and the major cities of the country. Then there's a second group, and these are the people who are in temporary accommodation, which is unstable, by which I mean they might be able to stay with your brother or sister for a couple of weeks, but it's not permanent. You're going to have to find somewhere else in a couple of weeks' time, or you're in a caravan, or you're living in a motel on Fenton Street in Rotorua, or any one of a number of those other temporary living space situations. So the number who are living hard, 3,500, and the number who are living in temporary accommodation, 7,500 now. So between those numbers, about 11,000 people. Now, that's still a lot of people, but I think if you said to people it's 11,000, they would be stunned, because most people think that number is much, much, much larger because of the figures that they hear through the media. So the people who are actually living in a situation that you and I would legitimately describe as homeless is actually a relatively small number of people. Now, let's break that number down, because if you look at the 3,500, most of those people, not all, but most of those people live in those circumstances. Not the reason that they're living on the streets got nothing to do with their economic position. It's to do with things like mental health issues, substance abuse issues, other issues which are impacting on their lives. And in a lot of cases, and when you talk to some of the agencies that look after them, you'll often find that they'll take these people off the street, they'll put them into accommodation, and a week later they're back out on the street, because it's got nothing to do with economics. It's not to do with how much money they're earning or what's available to them. There are a set of other issues, really important issues, that as a society we need to be cognizant of and work to resolve with them, but not about the economics of property. In fact, not about the property market really at all. That second group, that's...
Sorry, and I can, by the way, I'll just jump in because I can concur with that. Used to work with the homeless, granted, in Sydney, Australia. Yep. But actually, a lot of those guys and women who are on the street in the doorways, you're right, it's mental health issues, drug addiction, alcohol, and so forth. So, yeah, we have to help them. The other is that what I would often, and I argued this when Labor was in government, the conflation of the numbers, because they'd often combine the 3,000 on the street, the 7,000 in sort of that transient space, and then the 30,000 on the waiting list, and say there's 40,000+ people.
Homeless.
Yeah. And I argued clearly unsuccessfully is that actually by conflating that number, we end up not focusing, I would suggest, on the people who really need help. It just made it too big, too dramatic. Well, I was homeless probably by definition a few years back, where I was staying at a mate's house for a couple of weeks in between homes. That's ridiculous to conflate that with living with a drug addiction on the street. But that's the problem of overemphasizing or conflating numbers. Anyway, I've interrupted you again. You're the expert.
Oh, no, that's good. Because you're absolutely right. So if you accept those first two figures, 3,500 and 7,500, 11,000, that's about 0.2%. 0.2% of the country's population. Not in any way to diminish the importance of the need to help those people, but tiny percentage of the population of the country who are actually impacted. So my second point being, we don't have a homeless crisis. We've got a homeless problem that we need to fix like any other country, but we're probably in a much better position than lots of other nations in the West by dint of the history of this country and the fact that we have had state houses and a more enabling attitude toward things like accommodation supplements and things over the last sort of 40 or 50 years. So again, first crisis, affordability. I think we've dismissed that. Second crisis, homelessness. Dismiss that. The third crisis, and the one that this government certainly buys into and the last government with Kiwi Build also bought into, was this idea that we've got a supply issue. And so the supply crisis is the one that says, no, we're not building enough homes. We don't have enough homes available. By the way, I should just make the point, because I talked before about the number of people, and this comes back to your question, I talked before about the number of people who rent, and there's about 36% of people in this country who actually rent the home in which they live. So therefore are reliant on rental accommodation. And it's interesting because when you this whole idea, certainly from the last government to a lesser degree, this one is that Kāinga Ora is the solution to this. And I think a lot of people have that too. They think, you know, the government's got to build these houses because these people are homeless or in straitened accommodation circumstances, and the government's got to provide a solution to them. Here's the problem with that, and this is the thing I don't think Kiwis realize. Kāinga Ora only actually owns about 10% of the total rental housing stock in this country. It's always been only around about that sort of 10% mark. There's a few more owned by non-government agencies, might take that number. So councils, Salvation Army, a few others that own rental accommodation might take that number to 10, or let's say 15% of the total rental accommodation stock. The rest of them, about 500,000 houses in New Zealand, are owned by private property investors. And that's a really, really important discovery for two reasons. One, because it demonstrates that Kāinga Ora is not the great white hope that's going to solve this problem. It simply isn't a big player in the market. Private investors are by far and away the biggest. But secondly, and this is the bit that the previous government completely missed, private investors are absolutely essential to the housing market, to the extent that if they didn't exist and we had that 36% of people in the country who needed to rent accommodation, the state would have to step in and provide that, and it would bankrupt the country. And that's a really important point to understand. And the reason that's so important is because when you look at what the last government did to private investors and what it did to the private investment market, absolute insanity. Any government, if it's concerned about housing and concerned about making sure that 35 to 36% of the population has a roof over its head, should be doing everything that it can to make it as easy as possible for people to invest in property. Because those people are essentially taking that liability off the government's balance sheet and putting the risk of it onto the private investor. And that's the only way you can look at it sensibly. Anything else is insanity. Anything else is insanity. And yet you had a government, you had Grant Robertson and a government that were basically saying, we're going to get property investors out of the market because they're a blight on the market. Absolute insanity, Simon. Absolute insanity.
So it became just a direct attack, didn't it, on effectively the mum and dad landlords, a cheap political ideological point, attack the very people who are providing, if I've heard your stats correct, about 85% of the rental market.
Yep, yep. And again, that figure's been relatively consistent. New Zealand's actually very lucky in respect of its private investment in the rental market. And it's interesting because there's all sorts of views on how that happened. My personal view is it started in the late 70s, early 80s, and it started, and you'll remember this for other reasons that will relate to you, it started because Bob Jones was heavily involved in property investment back in those days. It's before he got involved in corporates. A lot of people listening to this won't even know who Bob Jones is, Sir Bob Jones. Bob Jones was an extraordinarily eccentric figure in the New Zealand political landscape. He was a property investor in the late 70s, wrote a book called Jones on Property and talked about property investment, ran seminars up and down the country. Tens of thousands of people attended those seminars, and it effectively transformed or created an industry that didn't previously exist. And that industry has just gone from strength to strength over the last 40 years. And it has meant that a provision of housing that would have been the government's responsibility has been transferred to the private sector, and they've taken all the risk of it over that period of time. So for a government to come in and say, we're going to do something about this and get these people out of the market, just insane. Just insane. Just completely misunderstanding how the market actually works. So the point you were asking me before, which is around the things that the current government's doing, they're doing exactly the right stuff, getting rid of the bright line test, or removing the bright line test back to 2 years, which is what it should be. By the way, the reason the bright line test came in the first place was up until the introduction of the bright line test by National in 2016 and whenever it was, there was some debate over what constituted an investor and what constituted a property speculator. And the difference between those is if you were a speculator, if you were buying and selling property quickly, then you were trading, which means you should have been paying money on the capital gain that you made on the property, paying tax on that. If you were a property investor, then the tax should have been on the income you made off the rental, not off the value of the property, because you owned the property over a long period of time. The problem was that there was no set rule on how long that should be. And so what happens is that IRD would often go back 10 years and look at your accounts and say, okay, you're a trader, and people would take them to court and IRD would lose. And so the government decided, okay, they needed to have a line in the sand that said, if you sell within this period of time, you're a trader. If you sell after that, then you're a property investor. And in the former, you would pay tax on that, effectively capital gains tax. And 2 years was about right, because if you're trading in property and you haven't sold within 2 years, you're not a very good trader. So anything after that, you're a property investor. So, and that was reasonable. Don't think anybody debated that. Labor then came in and increased it 5 years, which that had nothing to do with trading or property investing. That was just a capital gains tax. And then to 10 years, and that was definitely just a capital gains tax. So in putting that back to 2 years, I've restored it to about where it should be. The interest deductibility tax deductibility of interest,
yep,
is absolutely reasonable. It's the same as what we would apply to any other form of business. And the fact that we made a distinction and started calling it a loophole, which is what the last government did, was just obscene. It was taking away a balanced and even playing field and trying to introduce an ideology and mixing an ideology with an economic imperative and achieving neither.
It just increases costs amongst other. I mean, look, obviously, I've got my political biases, but exactly, it's the tenants. Exactly where I was going, the tenant ends up paying more because the landlord's having to pay more.
And you saw that. You saw rents going up over that period of time. It was a direct consequence. It's interesting. I say to people, renters who are upset, I say, well, if you want lower rents, you're going to vote for a national government, because national governments do things that bring the cost of renting down. Labor governments do things that push it up, because you end up paying for it. You're the fool that ends up paying. That's not entirely true, by the way. Because that's the other misconception that people have, this idea that that landlords are fat cats, and when they're putting rents up, they're just creaming the profits off them. In fact, in a lot of parts of this country at the moment, landlords are actually heavily subsidising their tenants because the interest rates and the rates and the maintenance and insurance and all those other costs of owning the property are far in excess on an annual basis than what they're getting in rent. So they're actually paying more to own the property than they're actually getting back on the property in rental. And so, as I say, subsidising the tenant. And people say, well, why would you do that? And under the current market, it's a very good question. Traditionally, the reason you would do it is because over the long haul, your property would increase in value. And a lot of people do that because they retire. They use it as a retirement fund. But you can't sustain that. You certainly can't sustain it in the current environment. And one of my predictions is that on the 1st of July, you're going to see an avalanche of property investors starting to put their properties on the market, because the 1st of July is the date that the government returns the Bright Line test back to 2 years. So there's going to be a lot of property investors who are just holding on by the skin of their teeth, who are going to put their properties on the market after the 1st of July because they simply can't understand to sustain them for any longer. So that's the next one. And then the last one was, as I say, this idea that we weren't building enough homes and we weren't building them quickly enough. And that's one that this current government buys into. It's this whole idea that supply issues threaten to derail the market. But again, and this is an unpopular view, and I think me and a cat somewhere in Otago hold this view, there is no housing shortage. There is no housing shortage. And I'll tell you why I can say that with such certainty. Because people say, well, how can you say that? Because, you know, this report, we've had this housing shortage for the last 15 years that the government's been talking about, both National and Labor have been talking about it. Let me tell you where that came from. It came from a Labor Party conference in 2012. And it was introduced as a policy, this idea that we were 100,000 short, 100,000 homes short. And it came from a policy that was introduced by Annette King and David Shearer. So that's how far back it goes. You remember those names, long gone from politics. And it got picked up by the Labor Party as policy. Labor, National, while they were still in power under Nick Smith, also bought into it and started doing stuff to fix the so-called supply crisis. And then, of course, when Labor came in 2017, they put it on steroids. Well, they didn't actually. They put it on verbal steroids, but actually did nothing. They introduced Kiwi Build, which was supposedly going to build this 100,000 homes, and I think built three or something. That's not fair, but it was, you know, it wasn't many. Anyway, here's the interesting thing about it, because then you would say, well, surely it was true, because they came up with this figure of 100,000, it must have been based on something. So I should first admit that for the first 4 or 5 years, I was a believer in there being a supply crisis. I bought into it. I kicked the National government in the shins over this and said you should be moving faster to get more homes built. And then I came to the realization I'm about to go through with you in a few moments and realized that it wasn't. And then I went back to find out where this Labor announcement had come from. I thought, well, they must have had some report or something they were referring to. There is no support report, Simon. And so I looked and looked and looked. I thought, where did this come from? Was there a university paper? Was there something? I finally found where it came from. And it's in Bob Jones, one of Bob Jones's books from 1981. It was the Labor Party's election manifesto in 1981. That's where that figure comes from. And they had dusted it off and they had put it out there again because it had been popular the first time they used it, and they thought they'd give it another go. Without a word of a lie, that is where that policy came from. It was a populist election idea that they thought would go down well with their voters.
Now, here's some of the rumors have been too that by the time it got to the more recent elections that Annette King, I think Phil Twyford initially had suggested 50,000, but they then thought 100,000 sounded better and more politically winnable.
It's just ridiculous. Here's why I can be so sure. There's only two measures that you need to look at to tell you whether or not you've got a supply crisis or not. Because a supply crisis, by definition, is you have more people than you have a shortage of homes because you have more people wanting a home than there are homes available for them. That's the definition of a supply crisis. So there are two figures you can look at to tell you whether or not that's true. The first of them is the population of the country, and it's really easy to measure the population of the country. You can get it on any given day from Stats New Zealand. They'll tell you what the estimated population is. Then the second figure that you need to compare with that is a figure called the average household occupancy, and that comes out once every 5 years. And that figure comes from Stats New Zealand. It's part of the census. And that what that figure tells you is if you look at the... Sorry, I've lost my train of thought for a second there. The average household occupancy tells you that if you go to the census, that's how many people lived in a home on census night. And that number's been dropping, Simon. It was 3.29 people per household in 1986. It's now dropped to 2.85 from memory in the latest census. Now, here's the thing. and think this through for a moment, the logic of what I'm about to say to you, the only way that number could drop, well, actually two ways. One of them is the population's has decreased, which of course it hasn't. Or the other one is you've actually built more houses than you previously had, and you've built more houses than you require just to stand still. Now, if you calculate those numbers, what they'll tell you is that between 1986 and about 2015, we built 585,000 more houses than we required just to start the level would have been in the 80s. So not only do we not have a housing supply crisis, we'd actually increase the housing stock relative to the population of the country. So there is no
supply crisis. Yeah, so what you're saying is if we had a supply crisis, we'd have more people living per home.
That 3.2 number would have gone up. It might be 4 or 4.5 or 5. It's not. It's come down. So you understand the logic of what I'm saying?
Yeah. There'll still be, I assume, averages, though. I mean, I can think of some, you know, thinking of my former constituency where you literally have three families shoved in. So you, this is picky for listeners.
There will be parts of the country where that number has gone up. So there will be parts of the country where there is a supply crisis, but there's not a general supply crisis in New Zealand overall.
And I think that's sort of the theme to get across to people. We're talking generals here. Everyone will be able to think of an example that's contrary to this, but in general terms, look, that's actually quite fascinating. Sorry, I've interrupted you.
No. So anyway, so let me summarize. So the three crises that we talked about before, housing crises. One was a crisis of affordability. One was a crisis of home ownership. And the other one was a crisis of supply. We don't have a crisis of affordability. I think I've demonstrated that pretty clearly with the numbers I've given. We don't have a crisis of homelessness. It's a very, very small number as a percentage of the country overall. And we don't have a crisis of supply. So the three things that we focus on when we talk about the housing crisis, none of them are real.
Which is, I think, going to stir up a number of people, but in a good way. And this is one of the reasons to have brought you on, Ashley, is actually to debunk some of the myths. I was trying to think of sort of housing mythbusters. But, you know, you're someone who's clearly looked at a lot of the statistics over time and been able to draw that here. So a big, big thank you. One last little, I don't know, question of not seeking financial advice, but particularly to first home buyers listening in, what would be your encouragement to them?
I'll keep doing what they're doing and work within the rules that are available to you. So a couple of rules. One, don't wait, buy now, because people are saying, time the market, wait, buy now, because it doesn't make the sooner you buy, the better, and the long-term consequence of that will be in your favor. And secondly, the rules are the rules, work within them and just get into a home. And if it's hard, work that little bit extra to get in. Don't wait till it's easier, because it's never going to be easier.
No, and look, I don't have your expertise, but I tend to agree with that. It's just like there's no better time than now. Get on that ladder. It's always, and it's never been easy. Ashley, I'm so grateful for your time and very much looking forward to the feedback on this. But thank you for not only doing a lot of that research, but distilling it into such a way that I think is quite understandable by lay men and women like myself. So thanks very much.
You're very welcome. Let's talk again soon.
You're listening to Speak Free with Simon O'Connor, right here on RCR, Reality Check Radio.
Well, great to have Toby Young on the program, the founder and general secretary of the Free Speech Union in the United Kingdom. Toby, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Simon. Happy to be here.
And welcome to New Zealand. Is this your first visit or you've been here before?
No, it's my first visit. I went to Australia with my father at the age of 11 for a kind of 2-week tour. Apart from that, I've never been down to this part of the world.
Well, welcome. Great to have you down here. You're leading such an important piece of work. I'm a great free speech advocate myself. So I'm going to start really, really broad. In fact, it's two questions. One is, why is free speech important? I don't think we can ever stop reminding people of that. And then secondly, why did you set up the Free Speech Union or the FSU about 4 or so years ago? You talk us through both of those. Why is free speech important and what led you to set up the union in the UK?
Yeah, well, I can think of at least three reasons. I may think of more in the course of answering the question why free speech is important. First of all, it's the lifeblood of democracy. We can't hope to make informed decisions of who to vote for. We can't hope to hold our elected politicians to account if we don't have free speech. Often there are really important debates, schisms within our societies, And unless we can talk them through, unless we can engage in a free and open discussion about them, then they're just going to continue to fester and become more and more divisive. That's the first reason. It's an essential component of a successful, flourishing democracy. The second is, well, we need free speech in our universities, in our science laboratories, because without academic freedom, then we're not going to advance the frontiers of knowledge. If people are inhibited about publicizing findings that they believe to be scientifically true because they're worried they might get into trouble for doing so, then that's going to retard the evolution, the development of knowledge. So it's absolutely essential for the production of knowledge, which is why the free speech crisis in our universities is so serious. And I think the third reason I'd say it's really important is that it's like a canary in the mine shaft. When a regime starts suppressing free speech, when they try and shut down dissidents, opponents, critics, that is a bellwether. That's the first sign that they are descending into totalitarianism. We need to keep a vigilant eye on free speech, because if we don't, if we allow the authorities to start punishing dissidents and critics, then that is the beginning of the end of democracy.
So why is it, one of the questions I'd written down, sort of I thought we'd be tying up on, but we've leapt straight into it. What is driving then people to want to limit free speech? Because, I mean, look, I agree with you on those three points. It makes absolute sense. But do you think, well, what is driving that authoritarian push? Let's take it in the academic space. Why is it that they do want to suppress different views?
Yeah. Well, I guess there's a charitable explanation and a less charitable explanation. If we're just talking about the academy, I guess the charitable explanation is that some misguided people believe that if certain points of view are allowed to be expressed in the university, they're going to upset historically disadvantaged, marginalized, vulnerable identity groups. So if you allow Nigel Farage to come and rail against mass immigration at Cambridge University, students from overseas, students from historically disadvantaged groups are going to be incredibly traumatized by that, traumatized and upset. It's going to make it difficult for them to do the work that they're there to do. So there's a kind of safetyist argument that we have to prioritize the safety, the mental well-being of these vulnerable groups. That's the kind of safetyist argument we hear a lot. And I think the counter to that argument is, by protecting vulnerable groups from hearing opinions they may find disagreeable, even upsetting, you're not in the long run doing them any favors. First of all, it's condescending to assume that they're not perfectly capable of fighting back, of rebutting offensive views, things they disagree with. But more fundamentally, if people don't develop the ability to withstand a bit of criticism, if they don't become mentally resilient when hearing things they find offensive and upsetting, then that's a recipe for kind of infantilizing them, for leaving them vulnerable to any kind of conflict they might encounter when they leave university. Part of the benefit, surely, of going to university is building up a kind of an immunity to hearing upsetting, disagreeable, offensive points of view, learning how to rebut them, how to get into the arena and fight back, not protecting people from that, because, you know, that's not going to set them up to thrive in the outside world when they're bound to hear many disagreeable things. I think the less charitable explanation is that, you know, free speech used to be a left-wing cause, including in universities, it's become less so as the left has become more and more powerful. The long march through the institutions has meant that people on the left are now in control. They are now the academic establishment. And so it's no longer in their self-interest to defend free speech. On the contrary, they can use various mechanisms to suppress free speech, to shut down criticism of the ideology they think it's their mission on earth to promote. As social justice advocates, they think it's going to help their cause if anyone dissenting from that particular ideology is punished and cancelled. I think it's often a combination of the two, and the people making the argument for banning Nigel Farage from coming to speak at the Cambridge Union, they often kind of shift between those two points of view. And I think when it's in your political self-interest to suppress a heretic, someone saying something you find disagreeable, someone challenging your point of view, rather than admit that the reason you want to no-platform them is to preserve your own political influence, you can persuade yourself you're doing it for more high-minded reasons. You're doing it to protect poor, weak, vulnerable people who you're going to save from having to be traumatized by this dreadful, toxic man. So I think it's often self-interest dressed up by the people doing the silencing as an act of charity.
Yeah, and sadly, well, we often talk, and sure you have, is pulling up the ladder. As you say, free speech has enabled such great benefits to our societies over many years. One even thinks of the civil rights movement. But yeah, now a lot of those people have been through that long march that you said through the institutions, manifesting certainly in the academic space, they're pulling up the ladder. And one thing that's always struck me, they don't seem to do the thought experiment, Toby, that if something a person is saying, you mentioned Nigel Farage, is upsetting a group of people, then surely in reverse is happening as well, that maybe their views are upsetting to him, but it doesn't seem to matter. Offence seems to only go in one direction. And as a free speech advocate, I'm sure there's many things that offend you, upset you, but you go, they're allowed to. That's mature.
Yes. Yes. And I think the radical progressive left, who are responsible for no platforming, cancelling, silencing so many people on the grounds that what they're saying may prove to be offensive or upsetting to vulnerable groups, to religious and ethnic minorities, they've exposed themselves as not really trying to suppress people they find disagreeable for these altruistic reasons. To protect people, they've exposed themselves by defending the right of pro-Palestinian protesters to protest outside synagogues, to chant from the river to the sea, to demand an intifada. That is clearly deeply traumatic and offensive to Jewish people. The Jews are a religious minority. Why should their feelings be any less important than the feelings of Muslims, say, who might get upset by Nigel Farage's presence at a university? But as you say, there it's one group is sacred and vulnerable and is deserving of our protection. Other groups, much less so. And the fact that the radical progressive left has been so careless about the impact of the pro-Palestinian protests on our Jewish communities suggests that they don't really care about upsetting, traumatizing a beleaguered minority. That's just a rhetorical device for camouflaging their real motive, which is just to shut down their opponents.
Sadly, and I'm sure you've heard about it as you're doing your tour, we've had the same dynamics here. Says me to you, it's that intersectionality problem that you end up rating who is or is not as much offended. And at the moment, particularly our Jewish community in New Zealand are under pretty, at times, violent attack. And yes, as you say, the usual advocates are nowhere to be seen. Free speech is saying, well, hold on a moment, be consistent. But it is quite striking where that sort of progressive side has gone and chosen to be quite silent. So, I mean, what led you then to set up the Free Speech Union in the UK? What was the catalyst?
Well, I was cancelled myself in 2018. I was an early victim of cancel culture. I was appointed to a new regulator of higher education in England by the then Prime Minister, Theresa May. It was called the Office for Students, and it was a nothing burger of a job. I was one of 15 non-executive directors. We were due to meet four times a year, had very little power on this regulator, but because it was a public regulator, I was formally appointed by the Prime Minister. The Guardian, our largest circulation liberal newspaper, got it into its head that I had a far more important role than I really did and described me as Theresa May's new universities czar. That was an open invitation to offence archaeologists to comb through everything I'd said or written dating back 30 years, looking for things to be outraged and offended by so they could dredge them up to demonstrate I wasn't a suitable person to be Theresa May's university czar. And because I'd been a fairly provocative, controversial journalist throughout my career, it didn't take them long to discover a Tutankhamun's tomb's worth of supposedly offensive material to dredge up. And after 8 days of being in the eye of this Twitter storm, I decided to step down and apologize for some of the more sophomoric things I'd said on X late at night after a couple of glasses of wine, imagining naively that this would draw a line under the affair and I could just return to my ordinary life. But actually, that was like throwing a hunk of raw meat to a shoal of piranha fish. The blood was in the water and they came for me in my four other positions. And I ended up having to step down from five positions. And I remember at the time when I was watching my career burning to the ground, desperately wanting an impartial professional organization I could reach out to that would give me good advice about how to cope. Is there anything I can do to put out this fire? Should I go out there on the airwaves to defend myself, or is it better to lie doggo? Should I apologize, or will that make things worse? Is there anyone who can provide me with psychological counseling? Because, boy, this is pretty traumatic. And there was no organization like that out there. So when the dust had settled and I'd recovered, I decided to create that organization, and that was the Free Speech Union.
Look, so importantly needed, and I know it's inspired New Zealand's setting up here because there's been such a big gap. Look, one thing I learned in my own political career, and it's not that you don't apologise for things that are duly to be apologised for, but in this cancel culture space, the thought of giving a little bit of ground and that they'll give up doesn't work. They just keep coming and coming. They want to destroy you because it's not just, and feel free to push back on this, but it's not just that you've said something wrong. They make the moral leap that you're wrong, you're bad, and therefore you have to be cancelled, not just your ideas. It's insidious.
Yes. I mean, one of the things about outrage mobs when they come for you that many people misunderstand and something we really have to drive home when people come to us for help, and we've helped over 2,500 people in the last 4.5 years. One of the things we have to get clear to them is that there is no possibility of redemption in the woke church. There is no mechanism by which you can be accepted back into the community of respectable people. It doesn't matter how much you apologize, how much you atone for your sins. In the woke church, there's no distinction between the sin and the sinner. Once you're a malefactor, once you have trampled on one of their sacred values, they just want to destroy you. And if you abase yourself at their feet and plead for mercy, they will just take that as a sign of weakness and, you know, start erecting the gallows.
Yeah, well, I've spoken on this before of sort of new priesthood, the new dogma, and effectively you're burnt alive in the square because, as you say, there's no redemption. I mean, one of the cases which locals, there's a couple of cases that locals have been following here. One's around Sam Malia. I think he's controversial views, but well, what's happening to him? It might be easier to put it that way.
Yeah, well, Sam Malia is a right-wing activist who was prosecuted in the UK quite recently for breaching the Public Order Act. And he was found guilty of intending to stir up hatred as well as conspiring to commit criminal damage. And his sin was that he produced various stickers and encouraged his followers and supporters to mass produce these stickers and stick them on public property. That was the conspiring to commit criminal damage part. And these stickers contained slogans like White Lives Matter and some more kind of obviously inflammatory slogans. And even though none of these stickers, as far as I know, were actually manufactured and used, he was found guilty of intending to stir up racial hatred, which is an offense under the Public Order Act 1996. And at the Free Speech Union, we make it a point not to defend people who've clearly broken the law. We just defend people who get into trouble for exercising their right to lawful free speech. And sometimes, you know, it's not open and shut and it's a gray area and we will defend them. We didn't end up going to bat for Sam Melia, partly because he didn't reach out to us until he'd been convicted. And we did offer to help with an appeal, but his legal team never responded. But I do think that prosecuting people for intending to stir up hatred is a step too far. I much prefer the Supreme Court of the US's principle that speech within certain boundaries, like without permitting child pornography or libel or betrayal of state secrets, provided you're not doing any of those things, speech should be permitted unless it's going to lead to imminent lawless action. And that's the kind of First Amendment gold standard. If you can't show that someone saying what they've said or what they want to say is going to cause imminent lawless action, then they should be permitted to say it under the First Amendment. And we used to have the same principle in the UK, which is the common law breach of the peace principle. Within those same limits, you should be allowed to say whatever you like, provided it's not going to lead to a breach of the peace. And the First Amendment is really just the American version of that English common law principle. But we've departed from that, and we now prosecute people for intending to, in effect, breach the peace, not just breaching the peace. And I think that is a threat to free speech. And in the long term, I would like to see that law repealed, but that's extremely ambitious. When I first set up the Free Speech Union, I naively expected that we'd be pulling back some of the restrictions on free speech, cutting away some of these vines to allow people to speak more freely. But actually, most of our legal work, our legislative work, is directed at stopping things from getting any worse rather than making them any better.
And if I might add to it as well, the inconsistencies around this are glaring, that we have people on the streets of the UK and here in New Zealand explicitly calling for revolutions, intifada, killing groups of people, and nothing's happening. And by the way, you know, it's that consistent approach, but it's the inconsistency, which I have to say drives me mad. I'm also seeing a number of your politicians, I'm conscious of your time, so we better begin to wrap up, but a number of your MPs, is it Rosie, I'm looking at my notes here, Rosie Dudfield's cancelling her appearances, is it Dave Cappenail is deselected because of his views, Mike Freer's an MP who's stepping away because of the abuse that they're suffering. Is this of alarm to you and the Free Speech Union there in the UK of how your politicians are reacting to the, if you will, the abuse that's happening to them and their inability, importantly, Toby, to speak? Because that's what they want to do. They want to speak. They fear they can't.
Yes, well, I mean, I think it is an issue, and it would be callous to not take seriously people who are leaving the political arena because they find the abuse they get, particularly on social media, in the end takes too great a toll. But I'm not sure that I would invoke that as a reason to police social media more vigorously and stop people saying things which at the moment are perfectly lawful, but which may be upsetting or offensive to some people. I think, you know, if you're in public life, you've got to have a pretty thick skin. That doesn't mean you have to put up with death threats or people harassing you outside your constituency office. Of course it doesn't. But if people are, you know, being rude about you, saying offensive things about you on social media, I think unpleasant though that is just part of the price you pay for being in public life.
And I totally agree. As someone who's been in politics, you expect robust behavior. I think there's just the irony at times, in my observation, that, yeah, the free speech of some individuals has been shut down by the very people who are calling for hate speech laws. They seem to be the same people who will turn up to your hustings and abuse you and basically try to de-platform you. Hey, last question, because I know you have to go, is can you quickly talk us through the debanking? I think that's what you call it in the UK. There's been attempts, I think, for the Free Speech Union itself, Nigel Farage last year, banks withdrawing services, and you've successfully pushed back on that.
Yes. PayPal, who we were quite dependent on, cancelled the Free Speech Union's account. Didn't give us any notice, didn't give us a proper explanation, just told us that they were shutting down our account. And I fought back. I managed to persuade something like 100 MPs and members of the House of Lords to write to the then business secretary, Jacob Rees-Mogg, to object to this and to write to the chairman of the Treasury Select Committee. And in the end, the head of PayPal Europe was hauled before the Financial Conduct Authority, and the business secretary condemned what they'd done in the Daily Telegraph. And as a result of that political pressure and pressure from the regulator, PayPal backed down and restored our account. But lots of people without my connections have been debanked, even some quite influential, powerful figures like Nigel Farage, probably the most famous case. He was debanked by Coutts, and again, they fobbed him off with an excuse. They didn't tell him the real reason, which was that they disapproved of his politics. He submitted a subject access request and discovered that that was the reason. And in the end, the chairman of the Coutts parent bank, NatWest, was forced to resign, and the CEO of NatWest resigned as well. No, the chairman of Coutts resigned and the CEO of NatWest resigned. Anyway, so it was a big victory for Nigel, and the Free Speech Union has been lobbying the government since then to make debanking much more difficult. We really don't want to see the emergence of a Chinese-style social credit system in the West. We saw Trudeau try to take advantage of his power to debank people participating in the trucker protest in Canada. That was a dreadful abuse of power. In China, people are kept in line, forced to toe the ideological line, because if they don't, they could lose access to banking facilities. And that's a very powerful tool of ideological enforcement. And we really don't want to see it in widespread use, any use at all across the West. And we did persuade the Conservative government to change the payment services regulations to make debanking much, much more difficult. But unfortunately, that particular piece of legislation, which was sort of in the parliamentary sausage machine, fell by the wayside when Rishi Sunak called a snap election a few weeks ago. So unfortunately, we're going to have to resume that campaign after the general election. But I think ultimately we will succeed. I don't think there's much political support either on either side of the aisle for debanking.
I'm pleased to hear that. I mean, look, it's insidious, that level of coercion. It's one, I am not in agreement with deplatforming, or as you say, no platforming people, but to take away their ability to bank, it has all the hallmarks of those totalitarian regimes that we see in the likes of China. Toby, it's so great to have you down here in New Zealand. I know that you have some more talks to go. I'll be making sure to put those up on our social media pages so people know where to find you. But if I could also say thank you for the advocacy that you've led, including around the Higher Education Freedom of Speech Act in the UK. I think that's sad that we need it, but really grateful for the leadership you've done there, because it flows down to New Zealand. We look, I think, quite closely to what you do. So very, very grateful for all your work and advocacy.
Thank you very much, Simon. It's been a pleasure.
So that was Toby Young, as you know, the founder of the Free Speech Union in the United Kingdom, and also now their General Secretary. I forgot to say as I introduced him, he's also been the Associate Editor for The Spectator and an Associate Editor for that very popular website for free thinking called Colette. So a man with immense, immense talents. If you want to catch him in person, he's in Wellington on Sunday evening, and on Tuesday, he's in Queenstown. So check out the Free Speech Union New Zealand website or social media to get all the details there. And thanks again to Toby for coming on. Well, I've managed to get hold of Bruce on the phone again. He tells me it's a very, very sweltering hot day there in Maryland. Bruce, welcome back to the show.
Well, glad to be back, Simon. Always glad to be back. Yep, it's hot. USA is a very big place. And from the Mississippi to the Atlantic Ocean, temperatures are sweltering. In the Fahrenheit, they're going high 90s to the hundreds. I guess I did my math here for you guys, and I think it goes from like right now it's 32 degrees Celsius. That's 90 degrees ours. And they're looking at it to go as high. They're looking at it to go as high as 38 to 40 degrees Celsius. That's over 100 degrees.
I think I'll stick to the 13 the 13 degrees that we have here in Auckland at the moment. Thank you very much.
Well, you're on the other side of the planet, so you get the other you get your winter. It's so strange for me.
So what's been going on in the States in the last week or so?
Well, it's the election. Now we're five months away, and it's all anybody can talk about. Let's see. A lot of you guys may not understand. We do everything backwards here in the States. We have our own weights and measures. We also have switched the colors. So the red is conservative and the liberal is blue. in any place else on the planet, red is the liberal. But what are you going to do? Let's see. Moving on. Simon, you sent me a question. Someone had inquired about the Electoral College.
They had. They were wondering how it all works, because we don't have that here in New Zealand.
It's really actually so simple, so very simple. Our founding fathers, in their infinite wisdom, said, well, we've got big states and little states. We've got states like Rhode Island, which is super tiny, and then massive states like California and Texas and Alaska. And they said, well, it's not fair that the little states don't get equal vote. So what they did was to say, okay, yeah, well, let's separate it. Let's have a vote for every member of Congress. Congress is separated. You get two states. Every state gets two states. Gets two senators. And then the House of Representatives is divvied up based on population. So California, being the biggest state, gets 54 electoral votes. Texas, 40. Florida, 30. New York, 28. And it's all based on the populations. So they said, well, if a candidate wanted to get elected and it's just by the majority vote, all he'd have to do was campaign in New York, Chicago, Los Angeles, and Houston. And the rest of the country, forget about, because that's where the population is, and majority would rule, and that's not fair. So that's how the Electoral College works. So it's a winner-take-all. Biden versus Trump. If Trump should win a state, he gets that state. All electoral votes for that state, and likewise for Biden if he should get his state. So it's a winner-take-all. And then they total it up, and you have to have 270 electoral votes to become president. And that's what they were confirming on January 6th when the manure hit the windmill, as they say. If I could, that's my own euphemism. Anyway, so that's the Electoral College, and it's. And they want, like, Senator Kennedy, is running, not Senator Kennedy, anyway, Bobby Kennedy's son is running for president. But he's only on the ballot on six states, which only allows him 89 electoral possible votes. So he can't win the presidency unless he's on more on the ballot on more states.
And hence there's also been the controversy. No, it makes a lot of sense. It also makes clear why I think Trump in a couple of states and Biden in several are fighting to be on the ballot. They've not done things correctly, or they've tried to be removed, but it's vitally important for them, isn't it, to be on all states' ballots?
Yes, and every single one of the states have their own electoral commission, and every one of the states then are fighting back and forth, and there's there's all sorts of shenanigans going on. But California's got 54, and then the smaller states like Wyoming, Vermont, South Dakota, they have three. You have two senators and one representative, and that's all you get. Washington, D.C. gets three just because. They should have. We've only got one non-voting representative from Washington, D.C., but they get three electoral votes. And that's electoral vote story.
Well, that's really helpful. I mean, I had put the question to you because a listener had been asking. Hey, I'm conscious of. Well, I've got to keep rolling. Tell me what's some of the big news at the moment.
Oh, Joe Biden and his feebleness. And we saw him at Normandy. We saw him at the G7 fundraiser. And then just last week, he was in Hollywood for a huge fundraiser, and he just freezes up. He goes catatonic, and so the right is saying, "Aha, he's not capable," and the left, Biden's team, are saying, "No, it's all deep fakes. It's artificial intelligence." So, what are you going to do with that?
Because I've seen the footage that they're saying that most of the footage is being faked.
That's just not true. They don't. Well, to be determined, maybe it's. But as I see it, and I think as most people see it, there's no jump cuts. There's no way it could have been where Obama grabs hold of Biden's arm and leads him off stage. You're not supposed to. That's weird.
I had seen it. Obviously I'm not from the States, but I thought it was a bad move by Biden to leave he didn't attend the peace summit on Ukraine. Instead, he chose to go back to a fundraiser with Hollywood celebrities. For what it's worth, Bruce, I don't think those are good optics.
Optics for who? It's the optics for the United States. I don't know. You've been here. Yeah, we don't work or pay much attention to the rest of the world. It's weird.
fair point.
It's so typically American. I mean,
no, that's good. I know, too, there's a bit of controversy, isn't there, across the political parties and people around whether there should be funding of Ukraine or not. So it could be quite a different perspective.
Absolutely. Oh, it's that. Well, that's the Ukraine thing is maddening. We should have given them whatever they had, whatever they needed when they needed it. But the infinite wisdom of our electoral body. What are you going to do?
Damn politicians. Hey, before you go, you were telling me that there's you've got some I use the term good oil. You're confused by that. But what's your take on Trump's nominee for, is it vice president? You said you might have some suggestions or thoughts.
Sure. Good oil. I have never heard that expression before. It's hysterical. It's great. to the VP contest, as it were, Trump's got about 2 weeks, or he's got 3 weeks to name a VP. Probably do it at the convention. But there's about six. You've got number one in the running would be Doug Burgum, who is the governor of South Dakota. He's a reliable, self-made man. He's worth a lot of money. And he's kind of central casting, looks the part. And he's super loyal to Trump. J.D. Vance, young guy. He's only 39 years old. Could be the attack dog for Trump. He's good on TV. Anyway, then we've heard of Marco Rubio. Marco Rubio is from Florida as well. He's a junior senator from Florida. And the problem with that is the Constitution says two candidates can't be from the same state. So but somebody would have to move in order for Rubio to be picked. Tim Scott, he's my favorite. He's my pick.
So what was that guy's name again?
His name is Senator Tim Scott. He's the junior senator from South Carolina. Incredibly kind, likable, lovable. His grandfather was from was from slavery. And so he uses the term from cotton to Congress. And he's, with the black vote, is a very serious vote for us. And it would be good for Trump to have him. And he speaks well, and he's good on TV. Then you have a few. Stefanik, Tom Cotton. He's an interesting character. He could very well end up Secretary of State or something. He's Harvard graduate, military vet from both Afghanistan and where else was he? Afghanistan. I forget where else he was. Iraq. He was in Iraq and Afghanistan. And very soft-spoken, very mild-mannered. He's brilliant at international politics. We'll see him in some position. And then, of course, Ben Carson, former Secretary of Health and Education, brain surgeon, also African-American, super nice guy. He's not going to be VP.
No, I've actually met Ben before. I just say lovely, lovely guy. I've actually met Marco Rubio a couple of times as well. He and I are on the same IPAC, that Interparliamentary Alliance on China. So, Bruce, we're going to have to leave it there for now. We'll obviously have you back again. There's so much to share, but it sounds like, is it Tom Scott? Did you say that's your Tim Scott? That's your pick.
Tim Scott. That's what I'm hoping for. What he does, it's Trump. Who knows what he's going to do?
That's right. We'll have to, listeners, we'll have to keep that name in mind and see you within 2 or 3 weeks if Bruce is right. Hey, my friend, thank you so much for joining me.
Oh, my pleasure, my friend. We'll talk next week.
You're listening to Speak Free with Simon O'Connor, right here on RCR, Reality Check Radio.
So it's that time of the show. It's the mailbag, and a great mailbag, or rather an array of comments, texts that came through. Unfortunately, because I've jam-packed the show, I'm not going to be able to get to all of them. So I've picked just a couple, and I'll respond to those and others I can pick up in subsequent weeks. Got a message from Rosie about the New Zealand health system. She says, I'm meant to have had a regular 6-month appointment, but this has been pushed back until who knows when, due to my specialist having to cover for the junior doctors that are currently striking. I was not aware of this until I rang the outpatients. I don't understand why we weren't notified that our appointments had been pushed back. How hard is it to send letters out and let people know what's going on? Well, I think, Rosie, this is just another sign of just how stretched the health system is. Found it through my own family, say delayed surgeries, the fact that things are not communicated timely. I'd also note, actually, it's particularly through my mum. She gets these automated messages, press 1, press 2. Unfortunately for her, she finds it quite confusing. So the systems are clearly broken and stretched, and it's not good enough. To put it really simply, it's not good enough. The next piece of feedback was no name, but says, no, Simon, Jacinda was not voted back in a free and fair election. You completely ignore that Jacinda held, with the connivance of mainstream media, the whole country in thrall, in absolute fear. This was massively manipulated. There was a coordinated propaganda operation. And I'm horrified that you, of all people, do not understand the forces and nudge units that were in play. Look, I only agree to a point insofar as absolutely the country was in a thrall. There were some who were completely enamored and thought she had saved them. There are others who, too much fear. And absolutely, we had media and others pushing a very, very strong narrative. So absolutely that had an influence. I'm not blind to that in any way. But I don't think ultimately that calls into question the election. And for the simple reason that every election, you're going to have a degree of influences that are in play on people. People are always going to vote for different reasons. So for me, free and fair is that the structures in place were correct. Why people choose to vote the way they do? Well, that's their choice. Personally, I would have loved a very different result than when Labour swept the benches, but people voted the way they did. And just as they will in coming years in elections, they'll vote for the reasons they have at that time. influence from outside or not. So that's sort of where I was coming from in that space. Others are commenting around the Māori Party case and wondering what's going to happen, because Constant asks, I'm really keen to hear your, as in Simon's, take on losing faith in our institutions, particularly if Tamahere is not found guilty of embezzlement. Well, I think that's why, Constant, it's got to be really important that the inquiry is fully independent, which at this point it's not. It has to be beyond reproach, so that whatever comes out, guilt or otherwise, we can have that confidence. And a few others noted, because we talked very briefly about Māori Party MPs wanting their own parliament. Julie says they won't leave. They complain about the wrongdoings of the Crown, but happy to take their money. And Deb knows, let them leave Parliament without any taxpayer money, and then you'll see them change their minds. I think both quite insightful comments. I'll return to other feedback in the coming weeks. But look, as always, thank you, and know that you can email at inbox@realitycheck.radio or text 2057.
We live in a world where politicians and the media and the dominant culture is to slice and dice us and divide us. What I love about RCR is it brings us together, joins us up, makes us feel part of something bigger than us, and builds this great human connection.
Within 2 weeks of my having a show on RCR, we had journalists from the legacy media begging the Prime Minister to cancel RCR. That's how used to suppressing the truth the legacy media have become. That's how quickly we can make a difference. They failed to cancel me, they failed to cancel RCR.
It's all about freedom in the end. Freedom of thought, freedom of speech, freedom of association, freedom of travel, medical freedom, freedom to bring up your own family as you see fit, freedom to say the climate crisis is a scam, freedom to say that the transgender movement is sinister. Freedom.
It's absolutely vital we keep this narrative going, because certainly the other side, the alarmist side, is really amping it up. I just find using climate and everything around climate, that was quite funny, really, wasn't it?
We are here to really transform the shape of what media is going forward, which is such an honor and such an exciting stage to be in.
You've got to have both sides of the story, and that's what we're here to do.
We want to have these conversations. We want to be able to talk about the stuff. We want to be able to say the things that you guys are saying to yourself in whispered conversations, in case someone else might hear at the supermarket.
Here, what we get is a checking of reality. And checking out reality is the very essence of our mental health and our survival.
I'm just going to return briefly back to my interview with Ashley. He's just texted me through, actually, an update on some numbers that he gave us near the end of our interview. He was talking about household occupancy rates. So you might remember he was saying it was about 3.29 people per house in 1986, and that's now dropped to 2,850 people. But he mentioned that we'd built 565,000 more houses. Or surplus houses. That's not quite right. He's come back to correct that we've built about 565,000 houses since 1986. But if you use the occupancy rate of 1986, then we've built 200,000 more houses than we need, per se. So no argument that we shouldn't be building houses. But again, if you are saying the occupancy rate in 1986 was what it was, 3.29, and we've built 565,000 houses, well, that's 200,000 more, hence why the occupancy has dropped. So anyway, Ashley wanted me to mention that. We want to keep our figures right here. But as always, if you have any thoughts or comments on anything he said or what we discussed, let me know.
You're listening to Speak Free with Simon O'Connor, right here on RCR, Reality Check Radio.
Well, welcome back to my lovely wife, Rachel. How are you?
Good morning. How are you?
Actually, not doing too bad. I just keep saying how these weeks just fly by. It was only like last week we sat down to chat.
Yeah.
And I think actually, well, we finished last time. We were asked about how we met. And so now people are following up with a bit of curiosity. What happened after the opera? But I thought I'd better remind, I don't think you need reminding, because of course we went to the opera, Rigoletto. You'll remember the first thing that happened, don't you?
Well, I admit I am quite conservative, and the curtains go up and the first scene is, I'll let you say, because I'm conservative.
So for whatever reason, as part of the interpretation, long, short, butt naked guy lying on the couch. I mean,
literally butt.
Literally butt out. It was quite funny. I mean, I'm not particularly prudish. I just thought it was quite funny. He's just sort of trying to make an impression on someone. So, you know, it was a tough competition from there on on in, wasn't it?
Absolutely.
So, no, I think after that, actually, we ended up in Mission Bay, didn't we? We went and got a coffee or a hot chocolate and went for a walk. It was just lovely. Lovely memories, actually.
It was indeed. And then we kind of dated as a couple for the next 4 long years. By this time, I was very in love, and Simon was, were you still unsure?
I'm a bit slow, I have to admit. I suppose I can't say it's not been a frustration for us, but I know you were getting frustrated going, well, what's taking him so long?
Yeah. So, but I guess what we reflect on is because I have 5 children, it just was a good time for the kids to get to know you. And you moved to various places, and by coincidence, you ended up buying an apartment that was right next door to my house. You'd been looking, and then you saw this property and said, what do you think of this? I said, oh, that's my neighbour.
That's right. I remember that because when I got elected, I moved very swiftly into the electorate and then, renting. And actually, I had wonderful landlords. If they're listening, you were absolutely wonderful because I started in one place, but then they wanted to renovate. And I was like, oh, okay. And they said, oh, we've got this other place we've got. It was a huge, like a 3-bedroom apartment. It was huge. Little old me banging around in it. You remember that?
Yep. And then you, with your intention to buy, and then you had been looking, and one came up and it happened to be next door to me. But I think that was really great. It was great for the kids too, because for 18 months you were my neighbour, and just that was a nice way for the kids to get to know you better. The whole time they kind of hung out a bit with you and that. So, yeah, it was good.
And it was coincidence. You know, I don't want to make this a case of the lady doth protest too much, but it was actually quite coincidental. But I remember, a few weeks after moving in, rediscovered some stairs between the properties. I dug them out. And so, yeah, the kids, and Rachel too, of course, at times, but could easily pop down. And so off in the afternoons, because I had Sky TV, you didn't, so the kids might come down and watch some appropriate TV, and I'll put the barbecue on.
Cook us dinner, at the barbecue, or you come up, whatever, it was good. It was good.
Because you had a change of circumstance somewhat during that time as well. You moved into what was a very small place temporarily.
For a while, and then came back, So there was a bit of, I think, between us, I counted in the, how many years were we dating? 5 years, that between us we moved 7 times. Although I still own my property and we had renters in and various things, but that's another whole story.
There was a lot going on, quite a lot of flux. I mean, it was sort of, we joke about it at one level, but it was also quite difficult because with me traveling so much, I'm away often, and when I'd come back tired, and so then trying to find time to go out on dates and catch up. I mean, we did, but it has challenges.
Yeah, but we could go 4 or 5 days without seeing each other. We tried to talk on the phone most days, but it was hard.
I think most days we did, but I mainly from my side, there were times where you're in the house, as in the Chamber of Parliament, and you're there till late, and if you're exhausted, so didn't always get the call through. But we maintained it. Although you at the end were like, "Are you ever going to ask the question?" I mean, basically, we were up north, weren't we, at a beach, and you effectively gave me a kick up the butt.
Yeah, and said, well, if we're not going to get married, then just I'll be upset, but that's it. So finally,
I decided to pop the question. You know what? I'm going to leave listeners dangling about how we pop the question, because I think it's quite funny, but it'll take me a little bit to explain. So maybe we can pick that up
another
time. But anyway, it's great to have you on.
Yeah.
Looking forward to the weekend, actually. It's going to be a nice, quiet, relatively quiet time for both of us, isn't it?
Yeah, it will be good.
Well deserved. This young one here, Rachel, she's been working very, very, very hard. Makes me look like a slug. So I think we're looking forward to a chance to go out for some nice walks and chill.
Sounds good.
It'll be good. All right, love. Catch you later.
Bye.
Celebrating Western values, our democracy, and our rights. and hearing perspectives from right here in New Zealand and overseas. We live in a big, well-connected world, so join Simon O'Connor as he talks to guests from home and abroad about the issues that really matter. Join us at 10 a.m. every Friday, right here on RCR, Reality Check Radio.
Thank you all for joining the show today. Look, I said at the start, I just don't know where time goes. Maybe I'm chronologically challenged, who knows? But it's just flown by. You know, we're coming up to midday. The day's half over. So thank you so much for joining me, joining in the show. I've appreciated the feedback that's already coming in, and I encourage listeners, look, do get in contact. I read all the correspondence. I'm sorry that today I wasn't able to reply in voice to all of it. The show got a bit jam-packed, but I'm loving all the feedback. So I just continue to encourage you, each and every one of you, get in touch, inbox at realitycheck.radio, or you can text 2057. And of course, there's all the options on social media. Reality Check is on the likes of Facebook, as am I, or Instagram, LinkedIn. Just so you know, I do all my own social media. I'm not always able to reply to each and every comment. Life is busy, but I do my best, and I very much appreciate it. Look, I really enjoyed the show today. I mean, look, I've enjoyed all the shows, but I found today is some really good, challenging, and insightful guests. So having Toby Young on from the Free Speech Union in the United Kingdom, for me, that was fantastic. His insights on free speech as a concept, but more importantly, how it's manifesting in the United Kingdom and his impressions here in New Zealand, very, very welcome. I mean, in some ways, I wish we didn't have to have free speech unions. In a strange way, I wish I didn't have to be a free speech advocate. It would be wonderful if our democracies just allowed and celebrated free speech. But as we all know, it's under challenge. Doesn't matter if it's our universities, elements of media, certainly in politics, a lot of free speech is being challenged. And so I find it comforting, for want of a better word, to be able to talk to and listen to the likes of Toby, to know we're not alone in this fight. And so I hope, amongst other things, you can take encouragement that not just Reality Check Radio, not just this show, Speak Free, but you know, there are people like Toby and the Free Speech Union in the UK, and obviously our own one here in New Zealand, fighting hard for your rights, your right to say, think, and believe what you want. And then, of course, Ashley Church. Look, he brings for me a refreshing array of thoughts in the housing space. As I said right at the start of the program, if you're picking up the newspaper, there are those, and they're welcome to. It's still a free country. They're welcome to have different views. They're wanting to collapse house prices. There's always the argument we need to build more and more. Well, Ashley, as you heard, has a very different perspective. So, you know, let me know what you think. As he challenges, he pushes a different narrative. He backs it up with numbers, but I'd love to know if you think he's right. So on that or any part of the program, obviously, if you want to comment on my little chat with Rachel, lovely she had time to pop back on. But if you've got any thoughts, challenges, critiques, whatever, get in touch, inbox at realitycheck.radio or text 2057. And in the meantime, you have a wonderful afternoon. Enjoy the other shows and hosts, and thanks for joining RCR.